Owen, how does TRIM, Tropical Rainfall Measuring Mission, see rainfall?
It's been called the flying rain gauge because it has every instrument ever used from space to measure rain. It has an infrared camera that sees how high and cool the clouds are.
We can see those images from GOES. GOES is a geostationary spacecraft. It hovers over the equator, looks down on us, gives us our daily weather pictures.
That's right. And since the 60s, we've had that view from space.
Because it's infrared, it's giving you essentially the temperature of the clouds, and the colder the cloud, the higher up it is in the atmosphere. So you can see how high, how tall the clouds are.
And that matters because air doesn't get lifted from the Earth's surface too high up unless there's energy being transformed into strong updrafts. So it tells you something about the physics that's going on inside the clouds. If you're, you know, looking at a sunny day and a little puffy cloud comes along, you don't get worried. But if you suddenly see it get dark and shoot high up and start to cover a lot of territory, then you know it's a big storm cloud and you might not want to set out on a hike.
And you can see that from space. The colder the cloud, the brighter it is in the image. So these bright white clouds, or even sometimes they're colorized, red and yellow, those are the really cold, high, powerful clouds.
What's nice about the infrared is that it works at night. You don't need sunlight to illuminate the cloud. You can just see how warm it is, and you know how high.
It's like putting your hands up to a stove. You're measuring how much warmth, how much heat is coming off that cloud, even though it's like minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, it can be even colder than that. Clouds at the top of some of these hot tower storms we look at are, you know, negative 90 degrees Celsius.
That's like minus 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Those are ice clouds.
Yeah, it's a different kind of cold. Even in the middle of the tropical ocean, over the Bahamas, clouds that get above about 3 miles high are ice clouds. Because the Earth being warmed by the sun, the atmosphere cools as you get further away from the Earth, the temperature falls off. There's a general circulation in the atmosphere. Air in the tropics rise generally, and then at high altitude travels to where we live and then kind of settles down.
As warm air rises, it cools down, like when you blow into a freezer, which makes its water vapor condense to form clouds, which make rain. So when air rises, it typically dries out.
And so there's kind of this wringer that squeezes all the water out before the air can come across to us. When you have high pressure systems in the part of the world we live in, that's generally sinking air, and that air is very dry.
And that's why you get the Chihuahuan Desert, which is mainly in Mexico, but it does stretch up into New Mexico.
Sure.
And that is one dry desert because you got that sinking dry air.
Sure. In fact, most of the hottest, driest places on the Earth are not directly at the equator, but at this band where you've got this sinking dry air.
How does TRIM see rain?
We've thrown everything we've got at the weather with TRIM. We have an infrared camera, just like GOES, so you can see the cloud tops. We have passive microwave radiometers, which just means a camera without a flash that observes radiation in the microwave region, same as your microwave oven uses. The trick is clouds are sort of semi-transparent in the microwave, and so you get a sense of the total radiation coming throughout the cloud, which would give you a sense of the total amount of water vapor in the cloud. But height matters in the atmosphere. It gives you clues about the energy transformations in the clouds. The passive radiometers aren't good enough, and so the third and most recent technology is a radar. TRIM is the first satellite to actually have a radar in space, powered with solar panels. It's a camera with a flash. It illuminates the cloud. That energy is absorbed by the raindrops, re-emitted in every direction, and a tiny fraction of that energy comes back to the radar.
The radiation is not being directly reflected, but it's being absorbed by these raindrops or the cloud droplets and then re-emitted in all directions.
That's right. They become little spherical antennas radiating in every direction. Traveling at the speed of light, it takes about a thousandth of a second for light to travel down a couple hundred kilometers, bounce off the rain, and come back to the satellite.
But you can measure things so precisely that you could tell if it's coming from down deep in the cloud or up near the top of the cloud by the time of flight.
By the amount of time, a fraction more or a fraction less, that tells you where it is, and how much radiation you receive tells you if it's just a drizzle or if it's a torrential downpour.
How close is this to the weather radar that we see on TV or see on our computer screens?
The frequency of radiation is similar. but the size and power requirements totally different. I mean, it's kind of a miracle to get this miniaturized enough to fly on a satellite and run off solar panels. The TRIM satellite's radar uses less power than the microwave you use to heat your lunch, and yet it can sense clouds that are as far away. Here I am in Washington. If I could see to New York City, that's about the distance that the clouds are away from the radar, all on a 1,000-watt charge. The machinery is huge for the ground radars that the National Weather Service uses, whereas the TRIM radar fits in something the size of a king-size bed.
When was TRIM launched?
It was launched on Thanksgiving Day, 1997.
Everybody aware of hurricanes is aware of the Saffir-Simpson Index, Category 1, Category 2, Cat 4, Cat 5. Robert Simpson was the husband of Joanne Simpson. What was Joanne Simpson's role in TRIM?
It's hard to think of the right adjective to describe Joanne. Joanne was a meticulous scientist, a motivated person that didn't accept obstacles. She basically made sure TRIM happened. She was the head of the science team that proposed TRIM, and she was head of the science team in the years just prior to launch. She also was a mentor to generations of scientists. So Joanne Simpson is the huge figure in the world. Her husband, Robert Simpson, didn't just invent the Category 1 through 5 scale. He also was head of the National Hurricane Center for a while. Both he and his wife liked to just look at clouds together. They were both fascinated by the weather.
Joanne Simpson, very early in her career, was guided into studying clouds because that was something that was more appropriate for a girl.
Oh, absolutely. I hope the world has changed for the better in some ways, because what she faced was rather unkind. She was one of the first women to earn a PhD in meteorology. After that, she wasn't allowed to fly on the aircraft collecting data for her experiments. And she just faced people who were dismissive of her talents because she was a woman. Some of her early work, where she meticulously analyzed tropical clouds over the Pacific Ocean, satellites didn't see clouds at that point. This was a couple decades before satellites could have made that job easy. And she found patterns that led to the hot tower hypothesis.
Which we will get into.
She wasn't allowed to fly on those aircrafts and direct where they went. Not only did she find ways to work around that, but she was generous with her time helping young scientists thereafter, so it didn't make her bitter. It made her care more about helping other people.
You were one of those young scientists. You were looking at the data. You saw a pattern in hurricanes. We all know that we have tropical rainforests because it rains a lot in the tropics. You were talking about how there's this flow of warm air rising off the tropics and then settling down over the deserts about 30 degrees north, 30 degrees south.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the picture, the cartoon in the textbooks, and you get this image of air just gently rising, flowing north or south, and gently coming down again.
Those pictures are about half a century out of date. It's a beautiful image of air just kind of rolling up and away from the equator and back down.
The vast part of that air rising is not rising so gently. It's coming up in thunderclouds.
That's right. Your and my experience would perhaps lead us to the same conclusion that Joanne Simpson put into scientific equations and scientific arguments. When you see a storm cloud coming, you don't see all of the air suddenly rise up and then light rain drizzle out. Rain happens really intensely, and then it won't rain for a week. So we all have some sense that the way clouds and storms work is often downpours. Now, I don't want to say that you never get this light drizzle that goes on for a day or two, because that can happen. In fact, those are the two modes of rainfall. It's called convective and stratiform. Convective rain is named after the mode of energy transfer called convection.
And that's what you get in a pot of water when you put it on the stove. You've got the heat below.
Exactly right.
Just like warm air rises, warm water rises.
Bubbles up.
Bubbles
that's
up,
right.
And then spreads out, and the cold water sinks.
And that is the type of cloud that frequently keeps tropical jungles moist, and that Joanne Simpson argued convincingly, and turned out she was right, she argued convincingly in the 60s that that is the cause of the general circulation of the atmosphere, the upward motion in the equator and downward at 30 degrees north and south.
In other words, these huge thunderclouds are what's lifting most
That's
of
right.
the air off the tropics and bringing it north and south.
And when you have bubbling motion like that with rapid upward motion, there's a lid that weather can't punch through, and that's the top of the troposphere. So if you've got rising motion, especially if it's very fast in one place, it has to settle somewhere pretty nearby because air doesn't disappear. That's one reason why convective storms have a well-defined scale. It's a sudden downpour, and then right next to it, it's not raining at all, or just lightly, because you need room for the downdrafts to kind of space out any convective storms that you have coming across.
I'm speaking with Owen Kelly. He's a research scientist at Goddard Space Flight Center. He works with TRIM, the Tropical Rainfall Measurement Mission. You're listening to Soundings. I'm Al Stoller. So we've got this picture of rising air. Warm air rises. As it rises, it cools. And like blowing into a freezer, when your breath cools, the water vapor condenses into cloud droplets.
Exactly right.
We're all familiar with sweating. Sweat evaporates off our skin. It takes energy. It takes heat with it. So it takes heat to evaporate water. When water condenses, say on a glass of ice water on a hot summer's day, same trick backwards. It gives up energy. Just as it takes an extraordinary amount of energy to evaporate water, to boil water, it gives up that exact same amount of extraordinary energy when it condenses. So you've got tremendous energy in a thunderstorm.
The trick is, a thunderstorm by itself probably won't last an hour. It may not be over your head for even that full hour.
Which is why vegetation in the desert is so spotty. It'll green up in one place one year and not at all in another place, because the desert will get a thunderstorm and that'll water those plants, but half a mile away, nothing.
But the interesting question that some of us feel, and I think building on Joanne Simpson's work, that's where she was leading us to go, these thunderstorms can either be building blocks for larger systems, or they can nudge a bigger system one way or another to intensify or just kind of peter out.
Bigger system, you're not talking about hurricanes yet, are you?
It can be hurricanes. Another kind of system is a squall line.
Let's do that first.
Where I live on the East Coast, there's a pattern of very heavy thunderstorms, sometimes with tornadoes. And they form in the afternoon. A line of storms will form off the Appalachian Mountains and then come eastward towards the coast and hit us before sunset. And these are called squall lines. They can produce very intense rain and hail and thunder and occasionally tornadoes. They're a line of hot tower storms, and the downdraft from one can form the next one. It's a whole system sort of built up of hot towers.
If you hold a beach ball underwater and let go, it'll pop up. These hot towers are air that's in an atmosphere that's so unstable, so ready for air to rise, that the air just rises and rises and rises, pops up higher than even normal thunderstorms, which is a hot tower.
That's right. It's not enough that you have all this fuel just waiting to be released. You also need to have a little bit of wind shear, because without that, if the wind was just calm, then the updraft would shoot up, the water would condense, form drops, and fall down, and that falling water would slow down and drag the updraft and kill off the storm within 15 minutes. To get a really strong thunderstorm, you have to have it tilted a little bit. You have to have wind shear, so the winds high up are pushing in a slightly different direction than the winds below, and so the storm's top isn't where the storm's bottom is, and the rain falls out not on top of the updraft.
We're all familiar with scissors being referred to as shears. That's because they have a shearing motion. You have the two blades of the scissors moving in slightly different directions. If you have two layers of wind moving in slightly different directions, or even just slightly different speeds in the same direction, you've got shear, and that will push the storm over.
But too much shear will not just push it over gently, but it'll rip it apart. I mean, there's lots of little things like that. Believe it or not, that simple idea of wind shear is an active area of research. Scientists don't know to what degree shear contributes to hurricanes and what degree it is detrimental.
An El Nino year is often good for hurricanes.
That's correct.
Because the trade winds die down, winds way up high,
That's right.
You get less wind shear.
You certainly get some. So if wind shear is beneficial, you have enough to be beneficial to the hurricanes, but the higher wind shears happen less often because everything in the atmosphere is fluctuations on fluctuations on multiple scales. So, yeah, if you just turn down the static a little bit, then it tends to be less destructive wind shear.
I'm glad you brought that up because, again, we look at the textbooks and we see these beautiful images, cartoons of the jet stream moving this way and that. What we're seeing there is the average velocity of the wind day after day. It's not like it's blowing constantly 24/7.
Right.
We've got these thunderstorms developing in the tropics. And as you say, normally they'll last an hour or a few hours and die down. They're individual. They don't have much effect on each other, though, as you say, with the squall line, one, as it's dying, it will build up the next, kind of like dominoes.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't last forever either.
Right.
Sometimes, over, let's say, the Atlantic Ocean, 15 degrees or so north of the equator, thunderstorms can become organized. How can you organize a bunch of thunderstorms?
Yeah, this is actually something that scientists are still trying to figure out. The basic story for how thunderstorms organize to form a hurricane frequently can be traced all the way back to Ethiopia on the eastern side of Africa. Winds moving over the Ethiopian mountains dodge to the north and south to get around the mountains, which sets up a wave. So you've got air moving north and south across Africa. As you pointed out, there's tropical jungles there with lots of moisture, and that causes thunderstorms to happen in sync with these waves that come across. It's about once every 3 or 4 days, one of these waves crosses Africa and comes off the end and onto the Atlantic Ocean. Over the Atlantic Ocean, there's much more moisture because it's a body of water, obviously. To get the thunderstorms organized, you need two things. You need fuel for thunderstorms, which is moist air, and you need kind of a wave to serve as a nest. These waves that oscillate north and south also have a little bit of circular motion in them. When winds circulate, it can trap the energy that these thunderstorms are releasing. Another way to think about it is take a cup of coffee and a coffee stirrer and spin it around until it looks sort of like a vortex. If there's a little bubble or something on the surface of that water, you'll see it just circles around and around wherever it is in that vortex. It's not going to travel out to the edge. It's kind of trapped within that swirling fluid.
And the fuel, as you say, is the water vapor, which will condense. So that water vapor condensing gives off tremendous amounts of energy.
I agree, although some scientists get huffy if you say that.
Because it's the sunshine?
Ultimately, the fuel is sunshine. Sunshine is the heat that drives the weather. And that heat gets absorbed by the ocean or by the surface of the land. Water evaporates from the ocean surface or from the soil. And only then is water vapor the fuel. I mean, there's a whole chain of causation that can be traced back to the sun. What you said is basically correct.
Some people like to point out that half of our iPods, iPads, electric vehicles, and all that are essentially powered by coal because it's coal that's generating electricity.
That's right. And sometimes it's useful to take a couple steps back and look at a familiar thing in an unfamiliar way. So I'm not saying it's bad for scientists to nitpick about exactly what is cause and effect, because actually that's where you get some of your good ideas. I think of the fuel of a hurricane as the water vapor that's evaporated from the ocean surface, and then what happens next is what's interesting to me.
What happens is you get thunderstorms. The thunderstorms get caught up in this nest created by the circulating air.
Right.
Then what happens?
Well, again, Jim, you keep asking me the tough questions. I mean, that's an area of active research. There are students trying to defend their PhD theses on this very subject. There's probably different ways it can happen. But the basic picture is you need to get a group of strong enough thunderstorms releasing enough energy close together that get kind of a warm pool of air. The wind starts circling preferentially around that, and you end up with a warm core hurricane. So it's feedback between some energy being released, which encourages winds to circle around a little bit more, which helps trap more energy, and eventually the feedback loop creates something different than just a bunch of thunderstorms over the ocean. You have an organized hurricane hundreds of miles across.
And if we accept that the fuel of the hurricane is water vapor and the ash, just like you take ash out of a wood stove, the ash is the condensed water.
Right.
You can measure the ash in a wood stove and figure out how much wood had been burned. You can measure the raindrops and the cloud droplets and figure out how much water vapor has condensed and therefore how much energy has gone into this storm. That's what you're doing with Trim.
That's what Trim does. Trim can't see energy. Energy is devilishly hard to see, but it can see the water that once carried that energy, and gram for gram, a gram of water that's condensed is a certain number of joules of energy that have been released in the atmosphere.
It's a tremendous amount of energy.
It is. To actually get water to evaporate, you need a huge amount of heat. I mean, honestly, I study hurricanes. I'm interested in weather. I'm interested in phenomena that occurs over scales of hours or minutes. But honestly, to understand climate, you need to understand what water vapor is doing and its transformations from liquid to solid, liquid to vapor, and every permutation of that. And it's such a huge amount of energy, I think that there's a lot of work to be done with that.
Let's take a quick break here. I'm speaking with Owen Kelly. He's a research scientist at Goddard Space Flight Center. He works with TRIM, the Tropical Rainfall Measurement Mission. You're listening to Soundings. I'm Al Stoller. Owen, you take the data and you program computers to turn it into visual pictures of what's going on inside a hurricane. They're very three-dimensional looking pictures, and you can see where the air is rising. You can see where the most energy is being given off. What kind of relationships do you see?
Well, in a hurricane, the place to look at first is called the eye wall. It's the ring of strong storm clouds that circles the eye. The energy that sustains the hurricane's low pressure center is released in that ring of strong storms. And it can have all sorts of different shapes. Sometimes it looks literally like a wedding ring. It's a circle of strong storms, uniform in height all the way around. Sometimes it's very lopsided. Sometimes there's a complete absence of rain on one side of a hurricane. And it tells you nothing for sure, but it gives you clues about a lot of things.
As a hurricane is passing over you, you get the most violence when you're under the eye wall. And then the eye wall passes and you're in the eye. And it's not like being in the teeth of the storm. The eye of a hurricane is a very gentle place. The rain stops, the sky can even clear, the winds die down until the other side of the eye wall comes in and you're right in the teeth of the storm again.
In fact, I mean, this is a public service announcement. If you've just been through a hurricane and it suddenly looks sunny and calm and warm, you may not be over with a hurricane, you just may be in the eye. And in the days before satellites, frequently people made that mistake and then went surfing because there were nice waves and it was sunny weather, and then the other side of the eye wall hits you and people perish.
You're looking at the eye wall with this data from TRIM, and you're turning it into pictures, and what you see are clouds rising up tens of thousands of feet, some of them like 50, 60,000 feet. That's right,
correct,
up to the stratosphere.
That's correct.
Those are hot towers.
That's right. NASA sends airplanes through hurricanes, and we know from experiments done in the last 10 years or so that even though it's impressive for a hot tower to reach 60,000 feet, if you fly a high-altitude jet above that, there can be severe turbulence, clear air turbulence. The last bits of ice particles have fallen out, but there's still so much kinetic energy flowing out of these thunderstorms that high-altitude jets in excess of 60,000 feet have almost had their wings ripped off, and pilots have refused to continue flying the mission because they fear for their lives. The system is even bigger than what TRIM can show you. We can only show you where there's chunks of ice or raindrops that are big enough to fall out of the atmosphere. Little tiny, like water vapor, can't be seen with our radar. We can only see chunks of ice and raindrops.
When Joanne Simpson began work half a century ago, she developed this hypothesis of hot towers, and then with other people, and was able to show that they do indeed exist, and they are indeed lifting tremendous amounts of air and energy off the tropics. But they also seem to have a relationship to the development of the hurricane. And that's work that's sort of petered out over the decades. And then you, in putting together these pictures, spotted some patterns.
It's not me single-handedly. At least a segment of the research community took a fresh look at Joanne Simpson's 50-year-old theories when TRIM launched. Myself and a number of others have come to think of hot towers as kind of energy pipelines. There are these protected paths by which energy can reach from the ocean into the hurricane. And once there, the hurricane can make use of that energy and convert it into kinetic energy of circling winds that become faster and more destructive. There's so many different angles to this. Kerry Emanuel of MIT said that the reason why he can't stop writing papers about hurricanes is because there are so many subtleties to the problem. It doesn't ever become boring. And that's certainly true about hot towers.
So you're looking at a hurricane, and there are more or less normal-sized storm cells, thunderstorms, even though there isn't much thunder over the ocean. Mm-hmm. There are these convective storms circling around in the eyewall, and then hot towers appear. What's the significance?
Well, scientists will argue a hot tower doesn't matter. It's too small. It lasts an hour or two at best. It's maybe 5 miles across. Okay, so it's 10, 12, 13 miles high. That's impressive, but so what? There's just not enough energy being released in such a short-lived object to affect the fate of a hurricane. So really what we need to think about is something called a convective burst. A convective burst is a sequence of hot towers that forms in one side of a hurricane's eye wall and persists for hours, even a full day.
So this would be like one beach ball after another popping up out of the water.
Right, sometimes two or three at once. Because the hurricane is a big blender, if you can just pump enough energy, a lot of it will get mixed up and eventually get converted into kinetic energy.
Kinetic energy being the energy of motion, in this
That's
case,
correct.
The energy of wind.
The energy of wind. What a group of researchers that I was part of did was calculate reasonable estimates of how much water is condensing in these hot towers based on TRIM observations. We can sort of bracket how much is condensing and multiply by the duration of these convective bursts, which, like I say, can be 9 hours, 12 hours, even 24, and found that even if you assume only a small fraction of that energy that's released gets converted into kinetic energy by the machinery of the inner core of a hurricane, there's more than enough energy released by a convective burst, by a sequence of hot towers, that even if only some of it gets converted into the energy of motion, that could intensify the winds, and perhaps that alone could cause what's called rapid intensification.
Rapid intensification, that's when a category 2 or a 3 becomes a cat 4 or a cat 5.
Right, in like a day. 30 knots and then 24 hours increase in wind speed is the rule of thumb.
30 nautical miles an hour.
And that may not seem like that much to call it rapid, but if you've already got something that's traveling at 75 miles an hour, another 30 is enough to make the difference between a scary experience that takes the shingles off your roof and an experience that takes maybe the roof with it. And remember, the destructive power of a hurricane goes to some power of wind speed. There's arguments about that too. Scientists are never satisfied with simple answers.
So if you double the wind speed, you might square that, so the destructiveness might go up by 4 times.
By 4 or by 8. People have gone around where hurricanes have made direct hits and examined exactly what sort of failures there were and estimated how much damage was caused to try to get a sense what is the power relationship between increase in wind speed and destructive force. There's different rules of thumb, like generally strong hurricanes tend to be larger, so it's not just that the winds pack a lot more energy when they get a little bit faster, but the hurricane also tends to be bigger, so a larger area is affected. All these things affect the exact relationship. The bottom line is, when winds that are already fast increase even just a little bit, it can be the difference between a scary-sounding wind and a wind that takes your roof off. Rapid intensification is one of the hardest things to forecast. Models don't do it very well. The only somewhat successful tool that's in use today operationally, you know, to save life and property is a statistical model. Scientists use statistical models when they throw up their hands and say, we don't know the exact physical equations governing this phenomena. We don't know exactly what's causing hurricanes to suddenly rapidly intensify. But we know by looking in the past that if the ocean is this certain temperature and the wind shear is this certain amount, then there's an increased likelihood of rapid intensification.
I'm speaking with Owen Kelly. He's a research scientist at Goddard Space Flight Center. He works with TRIM, the Tropical Rainfall Measurement Mission. You're listening to Soundings. I'm Al Stoller. What did Hurricane Sandy look like in TRIM's eyes?
I was looking at Hurricane Sandy. It was about a day before it was going to make landfall, and they were closing NASA down in Greenbelt, Maryland, because we were in the path. In a few hours, they were going to declare code red, and everyone was going to be ordered off NASA. And we got this amazing overflight that perfectly captured the eye and the eye wall.
Overflight meaning the spacecraft went right over the hurricane.
That's right. The TRIM satellite flew directly over the eye wall and the eye of Hurricane Sandy, which is the part of the storm that houses the machinery that transforms warm seawater into destructive hurricane winds.
That machinery is such a tiny bit of the storm itself. We look at these satellite images, and it says huge storm hundreds of miles across. What is generating that storm is all in a tiny area in the center.
That's right. It's about maybe 40 miles in diameter. Different storms are different, actually. They can vary by a factor of three how big they are, but it's still small if you consider Hurricane Sandy basically covered half the East Coast. Its outer clouds were that big. So yeah, it's a small area, and within that, there's even smaller hot towers that are only maybe 5 miles across.
Now, the machinery of Sandy would be especially interesting because it left the tropics and became an extra-tropical storm. We have mid-latitude cyclones here all the time. As we record,
sure,
we're enjoying one here in the foothills, and those are what bring us our rain in the winter. But they are very different from a tropical cyclone, in other words, a hurricane, and Sandy transitioned.
Yeah, the exact time that it transitioned is subject for debate and will probably take years to figure out. But the idea is a hurricane's fuel source is warm ocean water that evaporates. The fuel source for the mid-latitude cyclones that travel from California to Washington, D.C. once a week or so, their energy source is driven by weather fronts, temperature differences, and large air masses. What happened with Sandy, and whereas Sandy was fairly well forecast, it could have been worse if things had been slightly different. But you had this mid-latitude energy source of frontal energy colliding with a tropical source of energy, which was the inner machinery of the eye wall of Hurricane Sandy.
That frontal energy was that low-pressure system coming in from the west.
That's correct. Or at least the remnants of it. I mean, you could look on the Weather Channel and you would never actually see, you know, a circling mid-latitude storm bump into the circling hurricane.
With a big L in the middle of it.
Right, right. That doesn't happen in nature. It wasn't that obvious. But, I mean, I looked at the cloud loops, and I think I can see some interaction going on, but the trick is, was it significant in allowing more energy be converted into the energy of wind motion? And that you can't tell just by looking.
And that's why it's going to take years to figure out just what happened.
Right. There's debate already, but partially you have to wait for more data to come in because not all observations are available in real time. But what I saw with Hurricane Sandy the day before it made landfall was pretty convincing evidence that the hurricane machinery, so the original part of the storm, was functioning, and it was functioning rather well. There was an intact eye wall. There were no hot towers, which suggests that it wasn't rapidly intensifying, but then again, it was not supposed to be rapidly intensifying. It was on water that was marginally warm enough to sustain a hurricane. It was experiencing strong wind shear, and it ought to be dying out, and in fact, it had been limping along as a barely hurricane Category 1 strength storm. And the stronger a storm, the better it is as a container of energy. So whatever is released in the eye wall is trapped there. But if you're limping along as a Category 1 storm, you're not a very effective containment vessel. If I hadn't seen that TRIM observation, I would have assumed that the storm was done for, and any energy coming in from the mid-latitude system that was merging with it would be too late, and, you know, the storm wouldn't be so bad. But not that NASA does weather forecasts, and my opinion certainly didn't in any way influence the warnings that the public received, but as a scientist trying to understand how these storms work, it certainly focused my attention. Like I say, NASA was about to be closed down. The storm was headed directly towards my parents who live in New Jersey and my brother who lives in New York City, and I wanted to know what the storm was doing. Having a nice 3D shot of inner workings of the hurricane eye wall was nice.
You are part of a group at NASA that is now developing the next spacecraft to follow on from TRIM.
That's correct.
What will it look like?
It'll look like the big brother of TRIM. The radar on TRIM is the size of a king-size bed. The new satellite, which is supposed to launch in 2014, Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, will have two radars. So it'll have the king-size bed, plus it'll have another kind of the size of a crib in front of it, which is a different frequency radar. And with two frequencies, you can do really interesting things that you can't do with TRIM. With two frequencies, you can get a sense of whether the chunks of ice high up in a storm cloud are large or if there's lots of little chunks. Large chunks of ice reflect a lot of energy, and they could fool you into thinking there's a huge amount of water that's condensed, when really it's just a few huge chunks. It's called the size distribution. If you know the size distribution, you get a better handle on the energy transformations. GPM will do that.
Different frequencies are affected differently by different size chunks of ice. If you only have one frequency, and you say, okay, we got a good echo there, and we got a lot of ice, but you get a good echo with one frequency, a not so good echo with another frequency, you can say, aha, yes, there's a lot of ice, but it's all of a certain size.
Yeah, that's right. Another advantage is a souped-up version of the passive instrument, the camera without a flash. The GPM passive microwave radiometer will have extra channels, high-frequency channels that are very sensitive to small ice particles. That's something that is difficult to study any other way. That will help us study rainfall far north. And that's a good thing we've got those extra channels, because the reason why there's the G in GPM is because it's going global. The TRIM satellite stays in the tropics, whereas GPM goes to the northern regions of Canada and Europe and Russia. So there's going to be a lot of snow that we'll be observing, and it will give us a more complete picture of weather systems, including some very poorly understood systems called polar lows, which are like miniature, short-lived hurricanes that form sometimes over the ice sheets in the Arctic and then smash into northern Europe and cause great destruction.
One of the many mysteries that people have been working on for centuries is how thunderclouds make lightning. And some of the best hypotheses say that ice has something to do with it. Chunks of ice, maybe large chunks, get broken up into smaller chunks, and they bang against each other, and some of them take the negative charges here and the positive charges there. By its ability to look at ice clouds, will this next mission possibly give us at least some clues? I hesitate to say solve the mystery, but at least tell us more about how lightning is generated.
It probably will. It is not one of the top goals for the mission. Before NASA will fund the creation of a new satellite, there have to be very clearly stated scientific goals. A lot of the goals with GPM are things like understanding latent heating, how water vapor releases energy in the atmosphere, goals to better understand how rainfall gets incorporated into the possibility of floods and landslides and applications like that. So lightning is not the big focus of GPM, although there's an interesting development happening at the same time as GPM. There's a worldwide system of lightning detectors on the ground that can detect lightning even that can't be seen, that's over the horizon. And this network is getting better and better. And so pretty soon, we'll be able to measure lightning wherever it happens in the world. And so having very high quality rainfall data, which is the other half of lightning, because lightning doesn't form in empty air, I imagine it should be useful. Certainly when you've got a lot of lightning in a storm, it tells you there's probably some strong updrafts and you look at it more closely.
Oh, and it's always fun talking with you, and this conversation has been delightful. Thank you very much. I look forward to talking again.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to call us here at NASA.
I've been speaking with Owen Kelly. He's a research scientist at Goddard Space Flight Center, working with the TRIM spacecraft. For KVMR, I'm Al Stoller.